Today's episode will be different from previous ones. This is, of course, a podcast about climate change and climate solutions. But the issue on most everyone's mind right now is coronavirus, or COVID-19. We are witnessing a massive social and political transformation as we respond to the outbreak of this virus. Individuals have rapidly and radically changed their behaviors, from washing hands to self-isolating. Federal agencies and local authorities are attempting to stop the spread of this disease. We see in real time how quickly and effectively we can adapt to a crisis. We also are discovering where we have failed to anticipate and respond to a catastrophe we did not fully imagine. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 46 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, March 27th, 2020. In the Art House, you will hear an original radio drama, Survivor Generations 2165. We travel to the future and look back to the past to unearth inspiration for us today. But first, I am thinking about the many connections between the coronavirus and climate change. As we watch this drama rapidly unfold, what can we learn about our own climate work? How is the coronavirus outbreak similar to climate change, and how is it different? My brain feels too small to make all the connections I am sensing, so I contacted three incredibly smart and informed people. Each one is deeply engaged in climate work and resiliency. Each one is a serious thinker who, through their training and experiences, comes to a discussion about coronavirus with tremendous knowledge and insight. You will hear us discuss resiliency or adaptation. In doing so, we consider three questions the coronavirus raises for those of us concerned with climate change. First, what roles do federal, state, and local governments play when preparing for and responding to a major crisis? Second, in considering new threats we never experienced before, what role does imagination play? Third, and what about empathy? What role does it play when making decisions that affect everyone, including the most vulnerable? To discuss all this and more, I bring together a panel of experts. You will hear from Dr. Natasha DeJarnett, a regular on our program. Dr. DeJarnett is the Interim Associate Director of Program and Partnership Development at the National Environmental Health Association. In previous episodes, she has helped us better understand public health issues and climate change. Whether she's discussing environmental racism and pollution, the illnesses afflicting coal miners in Appalachia, or mental health in a time of climate change, Dr. DeJarnett provides well-sourced, grounded information. She presents it in a way that everyday people like me can easily understand. Also joining us is Leonardo Martinez Diaz, the director of the Sustainable Finance Center at the World Resources Institute. He leads the center's work to help drive finance into activities that promote sustainability and that combat climate change. He previously served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy and Environment at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. And we welcome Alice C. Hill, a Senior Fellow for Climate Change Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She comes with wisdom, thoughtful analysis, and experience to share. As a climate change resilience expert, Alice believes we possess the tools needed to respond to the impacts of climate change. Over 10 years ago, she joined the Obama administration as senior legal counsel to Homeland Security Director Janet Napolitano. I initially started a conversation with Alice and Leonardo about the book they co-authored. It's called Building a Resilient Tomorrow: How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. But as I spoke with them, the coronavirus outbreak loomed larger and larger. We were seeing an immediate need for resiliency and adaptation. These two terms are often interchangeable, but in the USA, the word adaptation does not always go down well. Leonardo explains that while for some, adaptation carries political baggage,
for other people, the idea of adaptation conveys the concept that we can just adapt to climate change, that if we just make these changes, that we can live with it and sort of keep going as if nothing had changed fundamentally.
In their book, they decided to use resiliency instead.
A lot of people understand what that means, the ability to absorb some of the impacts, the ability to recover from the impacts, and to bounce back from those disasters. So I think it's a term that is sort of more neutral and that most people can understand, from local government to business to civil society.
Alice shares with us her definition of resiliency.
When I joined the National Security Council, one of the things we considered is whether we should try to work towards a single definition of the word resilience. And we concluded that there were multiple definitions that the federal government had already issued. And we decided that, or I decided that I could spend my entire time that I was in the administration trying to define this word in a way that was satisfactory to all the agencies. So rather than do that, I decided it was more important that we actually embark on making policy. The rough definition we used was to be able to prepare for, respond, and recover from catastrophic risk. But when it comes to climate change, that means responding to these new types of events that are exacerbated by climate.
Now, you may notice an occasional wrinkle or crackle when Alice Hill speaks. Interviewing people remotely comes with some technical glitches. Dr. Natasha Dejarnet, a public health expert, sees similarities between coronavirus and climate change. She also views them through an environmental health lens.
First, the World Health Organization has called for urgent action on both of these threats to health. Both are affecting health globally, and we're experiencing the health effects locally. And both are connected to environmental health. So both are health emergencies. And though one is moving at a much more rapid pace, and that's coronavirus, that doesn't mean that both don't need our attention in the name of protecting health.
Now, obviously, coronavirus is a public health issue, and climate change is definitely an environmental health issue. But how is COVID-19 connected to environmental health?
Climate change harms health through a number of impacts, including air quality. And if we focus in on air pollution, there may be an unfortunate link between air pollution and coronavirus. You see, poor air quality can harm our respiratory and cardiovascular systems, and this is through pollution's interaction in our lungs. Harvard researcher Dr. Aaron Bernstein, an expert on environmental health, exposed a potential link in a recent interview for Inside Climate News. He explained that damage to the lung when breathing polluted air can increase the risk of getting pneumonia or even getting sicker when one gets pneumonia. Therefore, he reasoned that there may be a link with lung damage from pollution and potential susceptibility to coronavirus. Please note, there are many unknowns here. And to my best knowledge, this has not yet been researched, but there's a great and unfortunate opportunity for the research community to investigate further any association between air pollution and susceptibility to coronavirus.
Later in the show, Dr. Dejarnet will talk to us specifically about resiliency. I ask Alice and Leonardo to also share similarities and differences they see with coronavirus and climate change.
There are a great deal of similarities between the catastrophic risk of a global pandemic as well as climate change impacts.
Yeah, the challenge with climate change is that it doesn't have the time compression element that a pandemic does, right? Here we're watching all of these things happen in very rapid speed around the world in multiple countries and over a very short time period. And that really captures human attention. That's maybe why we were built back in evolutionary times, to react to the immediate present danger. And this is it. But climate change, because it's so much more complicated and regional and gradual, we have a lot of trouble getting our heads around that. But the advantage in some ways of this crisis is that it helps us realize that climate change would have similar impacts, even if they happen to be scattered a bit longer over time. And it helps us realize that there's these cascading catastrophes, right? Once you have people unable to go to work, then you have businesses going under and you have people unable to pay their mortgage, which means you have banks that are suddenly under stress, which means they could collapse and lead on to more and more consequences. And that's the same dynamic at play with climate change, except it happens at a slightly slower pace. But, you know, this allows us to realize how important it is to put a break into that cascade before it gets too far down the line.
In looking at both the virus and climate, deciding who does what is critical to success.
What we want with both climate change impacts and a global pandemic is the federal government to provide thought leadership, messaging, basic research, and supplies that have been stockpiled so that the nation is prepared for what we know will occur. The response happens at the local level. It doesn't really happen at the national level. So that means the national government is in a support mode, but that doesn't relinquish the national government from its responsibility to make sure that those state and local governments are prepared, that they have the necessary supplies, that they have the necessary messaging and guidance about what to do, that they have a chance to learn from each other through the federal government about best practices that have been developed. It shouldn't be up to an individual community to figure out what to do. They shouldn't have to discover the wheel on their own. And that is a fundamental role that the federal government will play for all catastrophic risks going forward, because the decisions will have to be made on a very local basis, but they'll need the research, the money, and at times the personnel from the federal government to get the job done.
And by not being prepared in advance, any actions end up costing the government and taxpayers much more money. This fact may ultimately help get more conservative lawmakers on board in embracing measures to mitigate climate change.
Conservative comes from the word conserve. In earlier administrations, some of the biggest environmental changes come from Republicans. I think it was traditionally part of their platform. It was Reagan who did the Montreal Protocol. It was under a prior Republican administration that we first got the Clean Water Act as well as the Clean Air Act. So this is a long-standing proposition. And I think that for the conservatives, they have a wonderful argument. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to work at the Hoover Institution, a center-right think tank, even though I'm a Democrat, I was in the Obama administration, is because this is an issue for anyone who is fiscally conservative. The costs of these events, including hurricanes, droughts, wildfires, will quickly overwhelm our economy. It's not sustainable going forward not to prepare. We know that for every dollar we spend preparing for a catastrophic event, we can save $6 or more on average in damages. So preparing makes sense for our purses, and it makes sense in terms of saving lives. I think it's a bipartisan issue, but I think it really plays to the heart of conservatives who view themselves as guardians of the public treasure.
Adequate and thorough preparation does not only save money, it also saves lives. As a child, Leonardo lived in Mexico City and experienced the 1985 earthquake.
And it was a huge catastrophe, killing thousands of people. And what I saw at that point was not only how a natural disaster can upend kind of civilized life overnight, but also how society can come together very quickly and work itself out of the disaster. And so at that point in Mexico, the government was famously inept and absent, really, in the early hours and days of the after the earthquake. And it was civil society that had to handle the burden of the recovery. And so I think that experience really stayed with me. 32 years, I think it was, to the day an earthquake again hit Mexico City. But the number of people who perished was a tiny fraction. And society really had learned a lot in those 30 years. Things had improved in terms of building codes and government responses and early warnings. So it is possible to learn from disaster, and I think that stayed with me.
Learning from past mistakes will help us proceed, plan, and build in new ways. For that, though, we need to engage our imaginations.
When it comes to a pandemic, we have suffered from a collective failure of imagination. That's always the thing that's identified after a catastrophic event. It was identified after Pearl Harbor, Katrina, 9/11, and now it will be clear with this that there's been a failure of imagination that things could go so terribly wrong. When it comes to resilience, of course, we need to prepare for all of these hazards, and we need to force ourselves to overcome what are usually termed cognitive biases, these defaults that we go to that keep us from imagining what is so big and so unfamiliar.
Leonardo talks about availability bias.
This problem of so-called availability bias, right? The fact that if we can quickly call to mind something, we're likely to assume that it is highly improbable and therefore not prepare for it. In the aftermath of 9/11 and the attacks, the government commissioned a group of experts to figure out why this happened and how to make sure it never happened again. And one of their more famous recommendations that came out in their famous report was that the terrorist attacks were ultimately a failure of imagination, that the agencies involved and responsible for keeping us safe had maybe thought about the possibility of hijacking planes and using them as weapons, but nobody had really taken that scenario and fleshed it out fully and created a whole scenario where that could be sort of visualized and then planned for or planned against. And therefore, one of the recommendations was the kind of paradoxical idea of institutionalizing or even bureaucratizing imagination, right? So you've got big government agencies, big corporations that are all about process and about predictability, not about imagination, suddenly having to somehow will themselves into being imaginative and creative. And it's that sort of tension that is one of the challenges we have to overcome of imagination.
Fortunately, we are seeing some examples where people are thinking beyond what they have experienced before. This leads to more resilient building practices. Alice gives us one example. Lessons learned in a storm that kept a hospital resilient years later when an unimaginably bigger storm hit.
The Texas Medical Center in Houston, a private facility, was terribly hit during Hurricane Allison and committed to never having that happen again. So it poured money into raising valuable equipment, higher flood-proofing entryways. And so during Allison, it lost functionality in virtually all of its hospitals. This is a 2-mile square facility. Compare in Harvey, the medical facility only had to shut down one hospital temporarily. The rest of the entire campus was able to continue to operate. And because they had planned so well, personnel knew they needed to get there. So there's a wonderful story of even medical personnel kayaking to work so that they could keep the hospitals running, continue to treat patients. This is very important during a crisis. So when we see these examples of leaning forward and being prepared for something that could be worse than what we previously experienced, it can save a great deal of time, money, expense, and even save lives.
As we experience larger storms, more and more extreme weather, and public health crises that threaten everyone, especially the most vulnerable, we need more than just intelligent planning. We need love, compassion, caring. As our problems magnify, so must our empathy. I asked my three guests about the need to enlarge our empathy.
It is a wonderful thought that our empathy needs to be in place and that we need to approach these issues with greater empathy. I'd never thought of that before, that empathy is critical, but it is, because there will be enormous amounts of suffering. We will see that some people are in harm's way through no fault of their own, and that's why we're all going to have to help each other find successful pathways to deal with climate change impacts. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of things that we can do now to make sure that everyone can remain in a much safer position. But as you pointed out, we need to focus as well on the most vulnerable in our society, because they have fewer resources and less of a buffer to handle the kinds of punches that climate change can sometimes carry. So our ability to understand and try to put ourselves in the position of others will be critical. And hopefully that doesn't take too much imagination. That should be something that we can all exercise to have better outcomes.
Dr. Dejournet echoes this point and connects it to the resiliency needed during this time of coronavirus.
We are resilient when we work together to help each other, to come out even stronger on the other side of a crisis. We're resilient because we support our most vulnerable. For example, folks are working to protect older adults who are quite susceptible to coronavirus. Communities are working to protect children who are dealing with schools that are closed, but those schools may have been the one place they were able to find consistent meals. So people are unifying to ensure that families have food.
I asked Leonardo to humor me with a thought experiment. What if he were to travel to the future, like 150 years into the future, and then look back at the many ways we succeeded in addressing climate change? In looking at all those various methods we transformed society and took on these challenges, from that vantage point, what stands out to him?
We could only succeed if we looked after the most vulnerable first, because regardless of all the progress that was done during those years, it didn't just stop and go away. It still took a toll on the planet. Along the way, it hit the poorest and the most vulnerable across and within countries first. If we were going to move forward in this process and survive it, we needed to first focus on those populations, the most vulnerable people, and figure out how to care for them. Because if we didn't, the inequalities that already existed would have become intolerably high, and it would have destabilized political and economic systems. So that's when the world realized that inequality and poverty were deeply connected to climate change, and we had to deal with both in order to move forward.
How we identify a problem influences the way we approach it. Several politicians, including President Trump, refer to the coronavirus as an enemy we need to attack. With climate change, our enemy is not so clear.
During war, we tend to react towards an enemy that is clear, that is tangible, and that is shooting at us, right? And here we're dealing with a much more abstract, difficult, and complicated thing. And so we have to be able to tell a story about how climate change is an enemy that has to be confronted with this kind of wartime mobilization-like effort. And we have to make this enemy, in quotes, as real as possible. It doesn't escape me that the irony, of course, is that the enemy is us in many ways, right? And that we have to figure out how do we use that to inspire action.
Having a shared enemy, though, may bring about a well-needed political change.
But hopefully what comes out of this whole episode is a renewed understanding that we have a shared interest collectively as a country and as a world for survival, and that we are a lot better off collaborating with one another with these transnational threats than we are by trying to go it alone, where ultimately no country can really mount a successful defense to either coronavirus or climate change on its own. So out of this tragedy, we come out with a better understanding of what ties us together and our collective effort to survive. That is something you can use in the politics of climate change. That is something you can harness towards a much more focused discussion about how to change our climate policy. And I think that's ultimately what is really going to be quite helpful. And hopefully it's something that allows us to push against all these forces of division and sectarianism and tribalism that we've seen over the last several years, and can show them for what they are, which is a real obstacle to our ability to survive as a species.
Climate resiliency is often about protecting the public and property from extreme weather events. Alice Hill challenges us to embrace climate mitigation as part of this resiliency.
I will say the most important resilience policy there is to cut our emissions, because we will adapt and we will be resilient, but it will be a lot easier if we don't have as much heat to prepare and recover from.
Still, these days, I find it hard to focus on anything but the current crisis that has upended all of our lives. The impacts of the coronavirus are only beginning to be felt. And unfortunately, there's still a lot more sickness, suffering, and sadness ahead for many of us. Additionally, growing concerns about the economy, unemployment, and political stability alarm many of us. Economists and leaders point out how this current crisis is a gigantic stress test on the banks and the entire world economy. As our leaders decide the fates of citizens and residents, I recognize the coronavirus and climate change are both stress tests of our morals and of our values. We protect the people, places, and things we love the most. Our resiliency plans are guided by our values and by our morals. No doubt, much of the political process includes conflicts and negotiations around some of these. Hopefully, though, when faced with these large existential threats, we will find the common ground we need for our shared survival. I'll end this segment with one more word from each of our guests. Alice Hill is a national security expert. Speaking with her has deepened my own understanding of what national security can mean.
For a lot of people, that just means the Department of Defense, the military response, that's national security. National security can mean also diplomacy through, for example, our State Department. It can mean development work, that is international investments to help overseas communities so that they remain strong and vibrant and can be strong allies to the United States, but also maintain global stability. When it comes to climate change, my feeling is that that definition can be too narrow, even taking the broadest, including the diplomacy and the development, including defense, because it doesn't get at the core of human security. And human security is what is so threatened by climate change. Our livelihoods are threatened. If you look at agriculture, if you look at fisheries, substantial changes in our ability to grow food and in the movement of fish stocks, and that will have profound effects across the globe. Water access, safe access to drinking water, agricultural water will be affected as temperatures increase. We're going to see the spread of disease, vector-borne diseases, as well as, for example, cholera during flooding. Just our ability to continue to live is challenged in many countries and places very severely by climate change. And that creates security risks that feed into traditional national security risks, but are just threats to human existence.
Even with stimulus packages already passed in the USA, India, Singapore, and other countries, likely we'll have more to come. Leonardo considers possible paths forward.
Coming out of this pandemic, there's going to be a real need to restart our economy, both in the US and abroad. There's going to be the immediate need to get money into people's pockets. But then after that, there's going to be a big stimulus package of some kind here and around the world. We need to make sure that when we start spending again, the government spending to get the economy going, that we're investing in things that are going to be helping us with climate, not just doubling down on fossil fuels. We need to come out of this pandemic making sure we're investing in our future health avoiding climate impacts and improving air quality and so on, rather than coming out of a disaster, health disaster, by betting on another health disaster.
Dr. DeJarnett reminds us that the coronavirus crisis is not the first time we needed to be resilient. We come to this moment with history behind us that can inspire us.
Gandhi is quoted for saying the true measure of a society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable members. This is why we're resilient. And it is this resilience that has accompanied us through so many major health and safety threats. And it will also bring us through the coronavirus pandemic as well as climate change.
Many, many thanks to Dr. Natasha DeJarnett, the Interim Associate Director of Program and Partnership Development at the National Environmental Health Association, to Leonardo Martinez-Diaz, the Director of the Sustainable Finance Center at the World Resources Institute, and to Alice C. Hill, a Senior Fellow for Climate Change Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Alice and Leonardo are authors of the book Building a Resilient Tomorrow: How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. You can get their book on Kindle and wherever books are sold online, and eventually in bookstores once they reopen. You can find links to my guest in the show notes. Just visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. On the right side of the page, click on the Citizens Climate Radio menu option, then look for episode 46. That link again is citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Now it is time for the Art House. We welcome to the Art House the Climate Stew Players with their radio play Survivor Generations 2165. Now imagine, you're living in the future. The year is 2165. It is a particularly good time to live on planet Earth. Because of the bold and creative actions taken over a century ago, the impacts of climate change have been decreasing. The infrastructure and responses developed over time protect the public, including the most vulnerable. There is now time to reflect on the past, and as a result, the most popular entertainment of the day does just that. Survivor Generations revisits times of extreme challenges to reveal the resiliency and determination of our ancestors. Sit back, turn on your internal viewing device, and enjoy another episode of Survivor. I am Timothy Meadows. Welcome back to Survivor, the world's longest-running television program, where we are doing a countdown of the top 20 Survivor generations of all time. Most people do not know about the atrocities faced by the citizens of Leningrad, what we now call Petersburg, Russia. Adolf Hitler rapidly conquered and annexed nations, then set his sights on Moscow. But before he could take the Soviet capital, he first needed to capture Leningrad, the Venice of the North, the seat of fine culture and the manufacturing center of the USSR. While never ultimately succeeding in invading the city, Nazi forces surrounded it for nearly 3 years. Four times a day, they rained down bombs in their devastating blitzkrieg assaults. The siege of Leningrad, with the death of over 1 million citizens, became known as the infamous 900 days.
Yes, they say it was 900 days. Actually, it was only 872 days. They exaggerate. No, I know, because I was there. I was just a boy when it happened.
Yuri Ivanovich Petrov, born August 23rd, 1930, had just turned 11 years old when the siege began in September 1941. We share with you archival footage from an interview conducted in August of 2001.
Growing up, I always was a fat boy. I liked to eat, and that birthday was terrible, because although the Nazis had not yet attacked, rationing had already begun, and it was very difficult to get my favorite foods. And then, right after my birthday, Hitler arrives, well, his forces. It was his belated birthday gift to me. Now, the Nazis, they were very consistent in their attack. They bombed us 4 times a day. And of course, the first thing they attacked was the Badaev warehouse. This is where we kept all of our food storage, which was stupid. I mean, the officials were warned to protect this. Do they think about the people? No. Gross mismanagement of disaster relief. So then, all we had was the rationings. Ugh. And it was not very much. For me as a boy, I would get 1 1/2 slice bread per day. But this was not normal bread. It was made with floor sweepings and linseed oil. It was this drippy, goopy thing they called bread. And so we had to be creative. We developed a whole siege cuisine. It is amazing what you can do with glue and shoe leather. No, but it was because of Badaev Warehouse that I began my career as a purveyor of fine foods. After the warehouse blew up, we went, my friends and I, to see what remained. Nothing. But there we found in the dirt, in the soil, burnt sugar. And we collected this dirty burnt sugar, and we packaged it in little boxes, and we traded it as a coffee product.
With bitter cold temperatures averaging 22 degrees below zero, no gas, electricity, or food supplies, along with the daily bombing raids, the citizens of Leningrad encountered a cruel and destructive winter. In January of 1942, over 100,000 people perished. By February, 20,000 died per day. While the citizens starved and froze, the city of Leningrad burned.
No, there were fires everywhere. Yes, well, of course, because of the bombings, yes. But also, we had to stay warm, and people would burn anything. Antiques, books, and of course, sometimes there were accidents and fires. Now, my mother, oh, she worked so hard, even though she was so thin and often sick. She worked in the factory with the other women much of the day. And then after work and early in the morning, she would go out and help dig the anti-tank trenches. And then all of the waiting online. She would wait online forever for the rations. She would carry with her a little tin box. And in this tin box were our ration cards. It was not very much, but it kept us alive. And it was on February 22nd of that first winter that I returned home. It was already dark. I turned the corner and I knew immediately what had happened. I saw our building with the empty window, smoke coming out like from empty eye sockets. And there, on the ground, was all the debris of the things that the people had thrown out who could not escape. Furniture and clothing. And there, among the debris, I looked and I found, dented and burnt, my mother's tin box with our ration cards. And I knew that at those moments, it was that she was thinking of me. Then the spring came. Oh, and all of the little green buds appeared. And you would find us children eating. We were so skinny, you could not tell if we were boys or girls. And then there was this cleaning frenzy. Oh, I don't know what happened, but everyone wanted to clean. And then we planted everywhere. They dug up courtyards and sidewalks, overturned tables. We planted so much food that by November we had a 4-month supply. And then the symphony began to play again. Yes, they were very tired and hungry, but they would play, and over loudspeakers we would hear this. Universities met in bomb shelters and discussed their dissertations. We refused to be defeated.
Stay tuned for the dramatic conclusion of our program as we share with you the greatest survivor generation of them all, the climate generation. That was Survivor Generations 2165, performed by the Climate Stew Players. Learn more at climatestew.com. That's stew, like a lentil stew, climatestew.com. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. Now it's time for our monthly puzzler question. I will give you more time to respond to last month's puzzler. Here goes. You're talking to your friend Charles. Charles is concerned about climate change, but he doesn't know what we can do about it. So you explain carbon pricing as a powerful tool to help us decrease fossil fuel emissions. Before you can say anything more, Charles interrupts. Are you out of your mind? Did you see what happened in France when they tried that? Those yellow vest protests? It was a political disaster. You really expect that to work here? So, how would you respond to Charles? Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by April 15th, 2020. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org, or better yet, leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 518-595-9414. Plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 518-595-9414. And if you didn't catch all that, I'll give you the contact information in a moment. Thank you for joining me for this very special and extra long episode of Citizens Climate Radio. Hopefully, the thoughtful discussion my guests provided have given you food for thought and some guidance as you continue your climate work in an altered social and political landscape. I would really like to hear your thoughts. Please feel free to reach me. You can contact me by email, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at 518-595-9414, plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 518-595-9414. Let me know if it's okay to share your thoughts with listeners. If you found this particular episode helpful, please feel free to share it with others through your social media, emails, and word of mouth. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Montorano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. We have a Facebook group page, and you can join the discussion by going to facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. To join, though, you will be prompted to answer two questions. You can follow us on Twitter @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. Feel free to tweet at me directly @P2Sun. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. If you're looking for more discussion about coronavirus and climate change, check out Global Goals Cast. There'll be a promo at the end of the show. It's a climate podcast that I've been listening to and I like a lot. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education. Please be safe. Let's take good care of ourselves and each other. And thank you for listening.
Hello, I'm Claudia Romo Edelman.
And I'm Edie Lush. We're the hosts of Global Goals Cast, a podcast that asks how we can change the world.
In every episode, we take on the world's biggest challenges, from global warming, poverty, gender equity, good jobs, health, and education.
And we don't just identify the problems, we find solutions and speak with people who are making a difference. And you can make a difference too. Mm-hmm. Subscribe to Global Goals Cast at globalgoalscast.org, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.